wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, your community radio in the time of coronavirus. And it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, a Monday morning radio zine coming to you from an intersectional, socialist, feminist, anti-colonial, and anti-racist perspective. I am Patricia Kohlberg, your host today, filling in for the usual Old Mole hosts. The Old Mole takes its name from Karl Marx's revolutionary image of the mole burrowing beneath the surface-level certainties of history to dig up the underlying social structures and ways of thinking that impede our progress toward a world in which everyone can reach their fullest potential. We offer interviews, commentaries, analyses, cultural reviews, and introspection, not only to critique the world, but to champion radically democratic, egalitarian, and earth-honoring ways of living and thinking and organizing for a better society. On today's show, we hear Bill Resnick speaking with John Rumpler of Environment America about the lax regulations of the tens of thousands of chemicals approved for commercial sale in the U.S., and how they've become a veritable chemical time bomb in our environment. Later on in the show, we'll hear from Joe Clement on the radical history behind pie in the sky, a rhetoric lately used to disparage Bernie Sanders. The well-read Red will read today from a commentary by Mike Davis on the way the coronavirus strips bare the global depredations of market-driven healthcare in the context of vast income inequality. And we will close out our show with a poem by Barbara Kingsolver, inspired by the burning of Notre Dame. In a day or two after broadcast, we will post the show at kboo.fm/oldmole, where you can listen to this morning's show in its entirety or as shareable segments. First on today's show, we have Bill Resnick speaking with John Rumpler, who is the Clean Water Program Director and Senior Attorney for Environment America, a national organization dedicated to protecting clean air, clean water, and promoting clean energy. Rumpler has spent years investigating the 80,000 chemicals that are approved for commercial sale in the U.S. and their toxic effects on our health and environment. They discuss the difficulty of winning in court against poisoning our environment, the uneven enforcement of laws against environmental contamination, and the inadequate approval process that neglects to examine, for example, the toxic interactions between chemicals as they are released together into our air, water, and soil. Here's Bill.
Hi, John Rumpler. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Bill. It's great to be here.
John Rumpler is Clean Water Program Director and Senior Attorney for Environmental America, an organization dedicated to protecting clean air, clean water, and promoting clean energy with a lot of supporters across all 50 U.S. states. John has directed numerous campaigns to protect our rivers, lakes, streams, and drinking water. He's co-authored several research reports, including Get the Lead Out, Fracking by the Numbers, and Corporate Agribusiness and the Fouling America's Waterways. He's been doing battle on the chemical and substance front to clean our waters and air and soils since 1985, when he was in the university and along the way he got a law degree. John Rumpler is one of those heroes of modern life, one hesitates to say civilization, who are trying to stop the horde of substances and chemicals that are showing up in increasing numbers in water, soils, air, food, mother's milk, the snow in our highest, most remote mountains. And those heroes are in constant battle with the companies and the scientists and the venture capital funds and the hobbyists who all are searching to make a buck by creating and selling, of course, some substances with some purported utility for somebody. And they're also in battle with public officials, some who went through the revolving door between company and government, or public officials who get nice campaign contributions from Dow or DuPont or Monsanto et al. And more and more, and also public officials whose popularity depends on keeping their local chemical or drug companies thriving and hiring. So, John, you're like a boxer who goes in the ring every day with heavyweight opponents and often doesn't win, and the opponents keep coming.
I guess I have a couple of bruises to show it, but also, you know, some important victories along the way that give us all hope that we can move forward and have safe drinking water and clean rivers and lakes and streams for all of us across America.
And maybe across the world, too, because the stuff that is poured into the water there finally comes to us, doesn't it?
Sure.
Not in the same concentrations, but more and more every year. John, first, give us a list of the many chemicals and substances that you've tried to stop or control in your 40 years of efforts.
Well, there's a wide range. Bill, as we know, there are something on the order of 80,000 different chemical substances that are registered for commercial use on the market, and the vast number of those chemicals have never been proven safe. Historically, the standard has been that these chemicals are proven, you know, they're presumed innocent until proven guilty, which is exactly the opposite of what precaution and a health-based policy would have for us. But some examples would include the non-stick and non-stain class of chemicals that we've known as far back as maybe some of us had Teflon pans. This class of chemicals known as perfluorinated compounds is increasingly linked to a wide range of health effects on people as well as wildlife. So that's probably one of the most, you know, dangerous emerging compounds. There's the whole slew of chemicals that are used in fracking fluid, as well as the naturally occurring, sometimes radioactive substances that come up in fracking wastewater. And then some of the pollutants that we deal with in our waterways and our drinking water are not so complicated. Manure from huge factory farms, whether it's dairy or beef or pork, sewage overflows that sometimes contaminate our beaches with fecal bacteria, or lead that we managed to somehow put into our drinking water delivery systems over decades, and now we're struggling to get the lead out, as we learn that even low levels of lead impact the health of our children.
Yeah, like, talk about lead for a second. It seems to me that it's not only finding out how toxic it is and then getting it banned in some ways and regulated. It's also getting people to enforce it, because lead is so central, in fact, in plumbing systems and in many other things. They got it out of gasoline. You're having some of your victories are now that schools are testing their water systems and finding very high levels of lead, and then, of course, distilled water in plastic bottles. Who knows how safe they are over time. The enforcement is also extremely difficult. It seems to me you have to keep fighting on every front just to get people even to test for lead.
Right. In our view, the reason why we called our campaign Get the Lead Out is not only to convey the urgency that expression has, but also that literally that is the solution. It is to remove the lead pipes, the lead plumbing, the old faucets and fountains that contain lead. That is the way to ensure that we have safe drinking water in our homes, in our schools, in our childcare centers, where our youngest and most vulnerable children are.
Yeah, are you also getting lead out of pellets, the munitions that hunters use to get birds and the rest of it? It seems to me that battle is just constant and going on.
That is not an issue that I have looked into. I have heard others raise that concern, but not something we're working on at this present time. just the place where we're focused is lead that is right in contact with our drinking water just moments before we fill our cups at the kitchen sink or a child takes a drink from the water fountain. There, the connection and the contamination is not speculative. It's well documented by thousands and thousands of tests that have been done at schools, that have been done from tap water and so forth. So that's why we're focused there, because we know the evidence is quite clear that we need to get the lead out.
Bill Resnick here at KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to John Rumpler, a Clean Water Program Director, Senior Attorney for Environment America. He's one of those beleaguered warriors trying to stop, at least control, the barrage of chemicals entering the water and soils and food and mother's milk and our bodies, of course. John, beginning of the interview, you noted the 80,000 chemicals that are being sold and used in the United States, and there may be some chemicals that even escape that. You're going at them one by one. It's got to be very frustrating because, in some ways, how do you reach those other chemicals that haven't been tested? You pointed out the assumption is somehow that they're innocent until proven guilty. It really should be exactly the opposite. But in any event, you're doing it one by one, and some of the worst offenders you've dealt with, pretty successfully, some of them, like lead, is being reduced. Asbestos is under control, at least, and it's being removed from lots of places, although not the homes of poor children. That would be expensive to landlords. But then there's the indirection effects. It's not just those 80,000 chemicals. It's that the pesticides and flame retardants and drugs and just the numerous chemicals that are being used, these microbeads that are now in all of our bodies and piling up that they use in toothpaste and other stuff, although that's been banned apparently. And what about the interaction effects? How do you deal with that question even?
Right. Well, I think scientists are still trying to sort that out. But increasingly what the evidence is showing is that these chemicals can have profound impacts on human health, even at very low levels. And when we look at, you know, maybe one set of chemicals that affects the endocrine system, another set of chemicals that weakens our immune system, a third set of chemicals that perhaps impact the reproductive system or neurological toxins that affect our brains, the way that our kids learn and behave and grow. You know, you look at all of these chemicals that are coming into our bodies, and there's no doubt that they're having an effect that where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
What to do about it, though, is the question. This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole on KABU Radio. I'm talking to John Rumpler, the Water Program Director and Senior Attorney for Environment America. He has been involved for 40 years. We've been talking about vast number of chemicals that are part of our environment that we breathe and imbibe and have to live with. We've been talking about great number of them that are considered innocent until proven guilty, and nobody is spending money on doing the testing. There are some, of course, but it's minuscule in comparison to the number of chemicals that should be looked at. John, how are us greater apes going to survive this sort of onslaught of chemicals? How do you see this in the long run? What has to be done, and how on earth can we stop the people who want to make money on these chemicals from just continuing their operations?
Well, Bill, I think, you know, earlier you were asking about, you know, the approach of taking on these chemicals one by one. And I think there, you know, there are times when we need to do that, where there's a particular chemical that is an urgent public health threat and grabs the public's attention, and therefore we can get policymakers to act on that specific chemical. But I also think there are more comprehensive approaches that we can use. So, for example, these perfluorinated compounds that I was talking about, which many people, one of those compounds, for example, was used in Teflon, and you know, people know them widely for non-stain and non-stick uses and so forth. We're now realizing the science tells us we have to address those as a class. There are something on the order of 4,500 different varieties of these chemicals, and we are pleading with state and federal decision makers to say, when you place a limit of how much of this stuff should be in our drinking water, it should be a cumulative health protective limit. Some scientists are saying it should be no greater than one part per trillion of all of these chemicals combined. So that's one way holistically to address these problems. Another is to look at operations, industrial activities that pose a wide range of toxic threats. So I was mentioning fracking. First of all, we need to be moving our nation to 100% clean, renewable energy to save the planet to begin with. But in addition to that, fracking, aka hydraulic fracturing, involves all kinds of multiple toxic effects, whether it is toxic air pollution at the gas site, toxic chemicals in the fracking fluid, radioactive materials that come up with the fracking wastewater. So these are multiple complex threats to our health. And if we can do away with this dirty drilling altogether, then we can address all of those problems together. So I think those are just two examples of where we can take a more comprehensive approach rather than just trying to fight, you know, 80,000 different chemical fights one by one.
That's right. Of course, that then leads to the problem of what about the Chinese, the Indians, the Europeans, the various other industrialized nations. But I suppose if the U.S. really began doing things, especially now on the energy front and the fossil fuel burning, it could have a major effect, particularly if the resources were made available to some of the poorer countries for some way of assisting them in saving their rainforests and all of the rest of the things that have to go on. This country is, we're in the belly of the beast.
I would say there are two ways that we can help on a global scale, or maybe even three. One is, remember that the American consumer is the driver of global demand and global manufacturing processes. If American consumers say, we don't want any more fabrics, we don't want any more carpets or upholstery or what have you with these toxic perfluorinated compounds, it's not worth risking cancer and contaminating our drinking water to have a nonstick pan when there are better alternatives available. You know, if the American consumer starts saying that, manufacturers around the world that provide consumer goods to the American marketplace are going to have to respond. The second thing, as you point out, is the lending of technology. I mean, we already know that there are places in the developing world that sort of leapfrogged over landlines and went right to cell phones, right? So they don't have to make all the same mistakes that we made. The great thing about solar energy, for example, is it can be so decentralized, with rooftop solar and small-scale or community solar panels. So this can be adopted at a small scale in local communities and reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, just as another example. And then the third thing is that, of course, our nation is home to many of the largest corporations in the world, and we can use our power here in the United States, regulatory power, consumer power, the power of investors, to shape the sustainable business practices of those operations and move in a way that is protecting our health as well as the bottom lines of those companies.
John Rumpler, that's a great way to end on an optimistic note. Thanks so much for talking to us. I mean, what we all agree on is going to take great national movements before those changes can be made. I hope that we succeed in time before climate change becomes irreversible and we go through a long period of global roasting that maybe end human life. John, sometime we can talk about what does it mean to build that kind of movement. I think it's possible, actually, around a kind of a Green New Deal politics. Why don't you get the last word, John?
Sure. On that subject of building the movement, you know, I just want to note that for your listeners that our state affiliate is Environment Oregon. And we could not do this work without the support of our thousands of citizen members right there in Oregon. So I just want to say thanks to all of the folks that have participated in our campaigns, given us the support to be able to make the progress that we're making today.
John Rumpler, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill.
Right. So long.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. Yo-ho, it's hot. The sun is not a place where we could live, but here on Earth there'd be no life without the light it gives. We need its light, we need its heat, we need its energy. Without the sun, without a doubt, there'd be no you and me. The sun is a massive incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. The sun is hot, the sun.
That was Bill Resnick speaking with John Rumpler about the commercial chemicals contaminating our environment. Still to come on the show this morning is Joe Clement on the musical history of Pie in the Sky and The Great Barrier, a poem by Barbara Kingsolver about our failure to love our planet. But now we turn to our occasional feature, The Well-Read Red. Today, I'm going to read from a recent blog by social critic Mike Davis, author of the 2005 book, The Monster at the Door, The Global Threat of Avian Flu, a prescient examination of pandemics in the context of late-stage capitalism. Davis's commentary on coronavirus was recently published on the Haymarket Books blog. Davis analyzes how market-driven healthcare in the U.S. has rendered the country uniquely vulnerable to the coronavirus. He also applies the lessons of history to predict the likely outcome of the pandemic in the global South, a topic shamefully neglected by the mainstream media. And now, reading from Davis's commentary. COVID-19 is finally the monster at the door. Researchers are working night and day to characterize the outbreak, but they are faced with three huge challenges. First, the continuing shortage or unavailability of test kits has vanquished all hope of containment. Moreover, it is preventing accurate estimates of key parameters such as reproduction rate, size of infected population, and number of benign infections. The result is a chaos of numbers. Like annual influenzas, this virus is mutating as it courses through populations with different age compositions and acquired immunities. The variety that Americans are most likely to get is already slightly different from that of the original outbreak in Wuhan. Further mutation could be trivial, or could alter the current distribution of virulence, which ascends with age, with babies and small children showing scant risk of serious infection, while octogenarians face mortal danger from viral pneumonia. Even if the virus remains stable and little mutated, its impact on under 65 age cohorts can differ radically in poor countries and amongst high poverty groups. Consider the global experience of the Spanish flu in 1918-19, which is estimated to have killed 1-2% of humanity. In contrast to the coronavirus, it was most deadly to young adults, and this has often been explained as a result of their relatively stronger immune systems, which overreacted to the infection by unleashing deadly cytokine storms against lung cells. The original H1N1 influenza virus notoriously found a favored niche in army camps and battlefield trenches, where it scythed down young soldiers by the tens of thousands. The collapse of the great German spring offensive of 1918, and thus the outcome of the war, has been attributed to the fact that the Allies, in contrast to their enemy, could replenish their sick armies with newly arrived American troops. It is rarely appreciated, however, that fully 60% of global mortality occurred in Western India, where grain exports to Britain and brutal requisitioning practices coincided with a major drought. Resultant food shortages drove millions of poor people to the edge of starvation. They became victims of a sinister synergy between malnutrition, which suppressed their immune response to infection, and rampant bacterial and viral pneumonia. In another case, British-occupied Iran, several years of drought, cholera, and food shortages, followed by widespread malaria outbreak, preconditioned the death of an estimated fifth of the population. This history, especially the unknown consequences of interactions with malnutrition and existing infections, should warn us that COVID-19 might take a different and more deadly path in the slums of Africa and South Asia. The danger to the global poor has been almost totally ignored by journalists and Western governments. The only published piece that I've seen claims that because the urban population of West Africa is the world's youngest, the pandemic should have only a mild impact. In light of the 1918 experience, this is a foolish extrapolation. No one knows what will happen over the coming weeks in Lagos, Nairobi, Karachi, or Kolkata. The only certainty is that rich countries and rich classes will focus on saving themselves to the exclusion of international solidarity and medical aid. Walls, not vaccines. Could there be a more evil template for the future? This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour, reading a commentary by social critic Mike Davis on the history of pandemics, the current outbreak of coronavirus, and the mainstream media neglect of what is likely to come in the global South. Before I continue with the essay, let's take a musical break for a song that was originally written during World War II by E.Y. Harburg and Earl Robinson. What follows is a later recording by Leadbelly, who was known to be a great fan of the song, entitled "We're in the Same Boat, Brother." It makes a point that we would be wise to take to heart.
We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. And if you shake one end, you're gonna rock the other. It's the same boat, brother.
Oh, Lordy, look down from his holy place. Say, Lord and me, what a sea of space. What's about to launch the human race? So he built him a boat for a mixed up crew, with eyes of black and brown and blue. So that's how come that you and I got just one world with just one sky.
We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. If you shake one end, you're gonna rock the other. It's the same boat, brother.
So the boat rolled on the storm and grief of many a rock and many a reef. What kept them going was the great belief. So they had to learn to navigate that human race was special freight. If they didn't want to be in Jonah's shoes, they better be mates on this here crew.
We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. And if you shake one hand, you're gonna rock the other. It's the same boat, brother.
Or the ball of blue somewhere in Spain, or the keel was smashed and for your grain. And the steam poured out from Oregon to Maine. Oh, it took some time for the crew to learn. But it's bad for the boy, ain't good for the stun. Oh, the hashtag fine China Bay, Pearl Harbor's deck's gonna blaze away. Cause
we're it's the same old brother. We're in the same old brother. And if you shake one hand, you're gonna rob the other. It's the same old brother.
One more. It's the same old brother. Oh, it's the same old brother. And if you shake
one hand, you're gonna rob the other.
It's the same old brother.
That was Leadbelly singing We're in the Same Boat, Brother, from the compilation album Leadbelly Sings for Children, released posthumously in 1999. This is Patricia Kohlberg for Old Mole Variety Hour, and now to continue with Mike Davis's commentary. A year from now, we may look back in admiration at China's success in containing the pandemic, but in horror at the USA's failure. I'm making the heroic assumption that China's declaration of rapidly declining transmission is more or less accurate. The inability of our institutions to keep Pandora's box closed, of course, is hardly a surprise. Since 2000, we've repeatedly seen breakdowns in frontline healthcare. The 2018 flu season, for instance, overwhelmed hospitals across the country, exposing the shocking shortage of hospital beds after 20 years of profit-driven cutbacks in inpatient capacity, the industry's version of just-in-time inventory management. Private and charity hospital closures and nursing shortages, likewise enforced by market logic, have devastated health services in poor communities and rural areas, transferring the burden to the underfunded public hospitals and VA facilities. Emergency rooms in such institutions are already unable to cope with seasonal infections, so how will they cope with an imminent overload of critical cases? We are in the early stages of a medical Katrina. Despite years of warnings about avian flu and other pandemics, inventories of basic emergency equipment such as respirators are not sufficient to deal with the expected flood of critical cases. Militant nurses' unions in California and other states are making sure that we all understand the grave dangers created by inadequate stockpiles of essential protective supplies like N95 face masks, even more vulnerable because they are invisible, are the hundreds of thousands of low-wage and overworked home care workers and nursing home staff. The nursing home and assisted care industry, which warehouses 2.5 million elderly Americans, most of them on Medicare, has long been a national scandal. According to the New York Times, an incredible 380,000 nursing home patients die every year from neglect of basic infection control procedures. Many homes, particularly in southern states, find it cheaper to pay fines for sanitary violations than to hire additional staff and provide them with proper training. Now, as the Seattle example warns, dozens, perhaps hundreds, more nursing homes will become coronavirus hotspots, and their minimum wage employees will rationally choose to protect their own families by staying home. In such a case, the system could collapse, and we shouldn't expect the National Guard to empty bedpans. The outbreak has instantly exposed the stark class divide in healthcare. Those with good health plans who can also work or teach from home are comfortably isolated provided they follow prudent safeguards. Public employees and other groups of unionized workers with decent coverage will have to make difficult choices between income and protection. Meanwhile, millions of low-wage service workers, farm employees, uncovered contingent workers, the unemployed, and the homeless will be thrown to the wolves. Even if the Washington establishment ultimately resolves the testing fiasco and provides adequate numbers of kits, the uninsured will still have to pay doctors or hospitals for administering the tests. Overall, family medical bills will soar at the same time that millions of workers are losing their jobs and their employer-provided insurance. Could there possibly be a stronger, more urgent case in favor of Medicare for all? You are tuned to listener-sponsored community radio at KBOO Portland. This is Patricia Kohlberg reading from a commentary by Mike Davis on how income inequality and a market-driven healthcare system makes us vulnerable to the worst effects of the coronavirus pandemic. And now, the conclusion of his essay highlighting the pernicious role of Big Pharma. But universal coverage is only a first step. It's disappointing, to say the least, that in the primary debates, neither Sanders nor Warren has highlighted Big Pharma's abdication of the research and development of new antibiotics and antivirals. Of the 18 largest pharmaceutical companies, 15 have totally abandoned the field. Heart medicines, addictive tranquilizers, and treatments for male impotence are profit leaders, not the defenses against hospital infections, emergent diseases, and traditional tropical killers. A universal vaccine for influenza, that is to say, a vaccine that targets the immutable parts of the virus's surface proteins, has been a possibility for decades, but never a profitable priority. As the antibiotic revolution is rolled back, old diseases will reappear alongside novel infections, and hospitals will become charnel houses. Even Trump can opportunistically rail against absurd prescription costs, but we need a bolder vision that looks to break up the drug monopolies and provide for the public production of lifeline medicines. This used to be the case. During World War II, the Army enlisted Jonas Salk and other researchers to develop the first flu vaccine. As I wrote 15 years ago in my book, The Monster at Our Door, The Global Threat of Avian Flu, and now quoting from the book, access to lifeline medicines, including vaccines, antibiotics, and antivirals, should be a human right, universally available at no cost. If markets can't provide incentives to cheaply produce such drugs, then governments and nonprofits should take responsibility for their manufacture and distribution. The survival of the poor must at all times be accounted a higher priority than the profits of Big Pharma. End quote. The current pandemic expands the argument. Capitalist globalization now appears to be biologically unsustainable in the absence of a truly international public health infrastructure. But such an infrastructure will never exist until people's movements break the power of Big Pharma and for-profit healthcare. Thank you to Mike Davis for that historically informed account of pandemics in the context of capitalist societies, and a troubling glimpse at the full tragedy of what we are facing in the current coronavirus pandemic. We'll close our show today with a poem by Barbara Kingsolver, but now we turn to Joe Clement as he digs into the musical history behind some political rhetoric Joe Biden has lately used against Bernie Sanders. First, we'll hear some historical audio of wobbly singer and songwriter Haywire McClintock discussing how he introduced some of Joe Hill's most famous songs on the streets of Portland 110 years ago. We'll hear the song he mentions, called Long-Haired Preacher and the Slave, and then Joe Clement's commentary on the perverse irony of how Joe Hill's anti-capitalist rhetoric ended up in Joe Biden's mouth.
Yeah.
Did you know Joe Hill?
Yeah, I know him well as anybody could be said to know him. He was a man of mystery. Nobody really knew the guy.
Where did you first meet Joe Hill?
Well, I think it was in Portland, Oregon.
When was this?
That was in the fall of 1910. And incidentally, I had the honor of singing The Preacher and the Slave. You know, the long-haired preacher song? Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
I had the honor of singing that for the first time in public. Joe brought it in and turned it over to the secretary of the Portland local of the IWW, and he got out a leaflet on it, and I think we sold at the Second Street meeting. The First Street meeting, we weren't prepared. We didn't have it printed, but the Second Street meeting, we sold over $30 worth of them at a dime a throw or whatever they wanted to contribute.
So you were the first one to sing it?
I was the first one to sing it in public.
Sing it now.
Long-haired preacher?
Yeah.
Every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. Falling mass without something to leave. They will tell you when voices are sweet. And you'll leave
by
in that glorious land of the sky.
Where
the prey live on hay. You'll be high in the sky when you die. Get on your phone on the ground, and they tell you when you're on the bomb. And
you'll leave by.
And that glorious land died.
You'll
pray, live on me. You'll get by in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
If you fight for the good thing, fight. Then you stop all the sheep or the boss you made, won't catch you on the way. And you'll leave
by
in that glorious land of the sky.
You'll
pray, live on me. You'll get high in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
When the folk of our countries unite, side by side the world ends well, we have gained. You're at me, sing this refrain.
And you'll
leave
by.
When you've learned how to cook and how to fly, chop some wood with the
good,
and you'll eat it to see by.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The song we just heard was The Preacher and the Slave, a latter-day rendition here by This Bike is a Pipe Bomb. And before that, we heard Haywire McClintock, famous wobbly singer-songwriter as well, talking about how he introduced the song on the streets of Portland. We'll hear another version of that song and some fun stories about those days from Utah Phillips later. I'm sharing it today to shed light on some remarks that Joe Biden made earlier this month on CNN about Bernie Sanders' campaign. We're going to hear a clip from that, and then I'll talk about his word choice.
Look, people aren't looking for a revolution, in my view. What they're looking for is they're looking for results. They're looking for getting things done. And Bernie doesn't have a very good track record of getting things done in the United States Congress, the United States Senate. And much of what he's proposing is very, very much pie in the sky. He's talking about spending $60 trillion and not raising taxes on the middle class and being able to get it done quickly and so on.
Pie in the sky. That common phrase is a neologism of the labor movement, invented by Joe Hill 119 years ago on the mean streets of Portland, no less. It was initially meant to skewer the otherworldly promise and pretense of bootlicking anti-union evangelists. The Salvation Army and other holy rollers are the named foes in this song we heard, Preacher and the Slave, but these words have transcended that context again and again in American culture, and ultimately have become a watered-down milquetoast cliché. That's why Joe Biden can somewhat get away with using them against Bernie Sanders on national television. Joe Hill's Pie in the Sky, though, was a critique of much more than empty promises and gullibility, but of the deferral of justice to somewhere outside of the present. The ideology of delayed gratification, of which Pie in the Sky is just one expression, is a cornerstone of capitalist society's own stories about the nature of well-being of winners and losers. Rather than appeal to the factual inaccuracy of Joe Biden's claims that Sanders' plans assume money that doesn't exist, we could emphasize the pie in the sky attitude behind the neoliberal churn to double down on capitalist power and priorities. In this vein, the economics of endless accumulation and the exploitation and extraction that fuel that are the real pie in the sky. The bloated private health insurance racket that we call a healthcare system is the pie in the sky. Trickle-down economics and incentivizing the competitive private sector to provide for the social welfare are pie-in-the-sky thinking. Calls to build our way out of the housing crisis, while millions of bank-owned homes and luxury apartments sit empty, is pie-in-the-sky thinking. Burning fossil fuels for another 30 years while chasing phony baloney zero net emissions targets is pie-in-the-sky thinking. When the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has given us to the end of this decade to do the lion's share of work of dismantling our use of fossil fuels. But Joe Biden's invocation of pie in the sky has a much deeper history than the actual words. In its historical context, the ruling class considered the abolition of slavery to be pie in the sky, giving women the right to vote or have autonomy over their own bodies at different places in history was considered pie in the sky. Throwing off the shackles of Jim Crow and demanding full equality was considered pie in the sky. It's often said that we need to grow the pie so that everyone can have shared prosperity. But we need to take over the bakery so that we can feed ourselves before the capitalist system sucks up or corrupts every human and natural resource. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement.
Joe Hill wrote a song for the free speech fight of 1910 and was introduced by Haywire Mac McClintock. He wrote Big Rock Candy Mountain and Hallelujah I'm a Bum. He got together a little band, T-Bone Slim, a tuba, a garbage can lid. They stood in a doorway, waiting to leap out at the unemployed throng, regale them with song. They used a shill to build the crowd. You know, a carny shill? Somebody uses tricks to build a crowd. I think his name was Tresca, but he wore a black suit, a black bowler hat, a string tie with an umbrella and a briefcase, looked like a banker. He'd walk down where they were hiding in the doorway, and suddenly start to yell, "Help! Help! Help! I've been robbed! Help! I've been robbed!" Everybody'd run across the street. "What's the matter? What's the matter?" As soon as he got the crowd together, he'd yell, "I've been robbed by the capitalist system, fellow workers!" He talked to them for 10 minutes, and then the boys would leap out and start singing, and this is what they were singing. The long-haired preachers come out every night. I try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked about something to eat, they will answer in voices as sweet. You will eat by and by in that glorious land in the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get by in the sky when you die. That's a lie. Oh, that's real nice. Let's take a minute and teach the folks that don't know this what this is. Now, this is done Baptist style. Are there any Baptists here? Oh, good. Answer back, you know, where I sing one thing and then you sing it back and then we sing a line together. And the way up highs are yours, not mine. They're the prettiest part of the whole song.
You will eat,
by
and by,
in that glorious land in the sky,
way up high,
work and pray,
live on hay,
you'll get pie in the sky when you die,
that's a lie!
The long-haired preachers come out every night, I try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked about something to eat, they'll answer in voices so sweet. Hey,
you will eat
by and by, in that glorious land in the sky.
Work and pray,
live on hay. You'll get by in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
The Starvation Army, they play. And they shout and they clap and they pray. when they've got all your coins on the drum, they will tell you when you're on the bum. Hey, you will eat by and by, high in that glorious land in the sky. Work and pray, and live on hay, and you'll get by in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
Working folks of all countries unite, side by side we for freedom shall fight. When this world and this wealth we have gained, the grafters will sing this refrain. Hey, you will eat by and by, when you've learned how to cook and how to fry. Chop some wood, do you good, and you'll eat in that sweet by and by. That's no lie.
That was Utah Phillips at the end, singing Joe Hill's famous labor hymn, Long-Haired Preacher and the Slave. Before that, Joe Clement commented on how that song put pie in the sky into the American lexicon and the perverse irony of Joe Biden using it to describe Bernie Sanders' platform. To close our show today, I'm going to read a poem by Barbara Kingsolver entitled The Great Barrier. The poem was inspired by the burning of Notre Dame nearly 1 year ago, which Kingsolver renders into an ironic commentary on the devastation of global warming. The Great Barrier. The cathedral is burning, absent flame or smoke. Stained glass explodes in silence, fractal scales of angel, damsel, rainbow, parrot, charred beams of blackened coral lie in heaps on the sacred floor. White stones fallen from high places, spires collapsed, crushing sainted turtle and gargoyle octopus. Something there is in my kind that cannot love, a reef, a tundra, a plain stone breast of desert ever quite enough. A tree perhaps once recomposed, as splendid furniture, a forest after the whole of it is planed to posts and beams and raised to a heaven of earnest construction in the name of Our Lady. All Paris stood on the bridges to watch her burning, believing a thing this old, this large and beautiful must be holy and cannot be lost, and coral temples older than Charlemagne suffocate unattended, bleach and bleed from the eye, the centered heart. Lord of leaves and fishes, lead me across this great divide. Teach me how to love the sacred places, not as one devotes to one who made me in his image and is bound to love me back. I mean as a body loves its microbial skin, the worm, its nape of loam, all secret otherness forgiven, love beyond anything I will ever make of it. That was the Barbara Kingsolver poem called The Great Barrier. This is Patricia Kullberg, and I have been your host today, filling in for the Old Moles, who produced today's show. I want to thank Bill Resnick for his discussion with John Rumpler of Environment America about the chemical time bomb in the U.S., and Joe Clement for his musical history of Pie in the Sky. Thanks as well to Denise Morris for her help in producing today's show. Every Monday morning, the Old Mole speaks truth to power, offering a picture of this country from the point of view of the 99%. And a vision of a radically democratic world with ordinary people involved in the decisions that shape their lives, struggling to build a just and sustainable world. Join us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for more interviews, reviews, and commentary from a socialist feminist perspective. As always, you can find a downloadable podcast of today's show and its individual segments in a day or two on the KBOO website, with links to further material that might interest you. You can contact us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay well.